not knowing, thereby giving up fixed ideas about myself and the universe, I vow to cease from evil. Bearing witness to the joy and suffering of the world, I vow to practice good. Honoring wholeness in myself and others, I vow to save all beings. So this morning I want to talk about saving all beings in a few minutes. So if you've been waiting for the answer, if you've been wondering how to do it, here is your instruction book. One of the things that arises in my mind whenever I take these three pure precepts to heart is how impossible they are. Avoiding evil, well, maybe. Doing good, yeah, I can do that. But saving all beings, really? Can I save all beings? This little aging body, this one skin bag, how is that possible? So what always comes to mind when I consider this is a story from traditional Buddhism that some of you have heard me tell before. I did a little bit of research on this story just because I wasn't sure I remembered it right, and indeed, there are many, many versions of this story. The first time I heard it in one way, and that's the first way I'm going to tell it. It's pretty brief, and then I'm going to tell you a few other things about the precepts. This is my plan. And then I'm going to tell the story again in another way that I heard it later in my life. So when I first heard this story, it's a Jataka story, which is a story about the previous incarnations of the Buddha. And in traditional Buddhism, unlike in Zen, there's a lot made of past lives and future lives and how many lives it takes to become a Buddha. Of course, in Zen, it's we have is it a loophole? We say, we're already awake, we're already Buddhas. We don't believe it because look at us, we're just wrecks and broken and horrible. But the teaching that we keep telling you is that this wrecked, broken, horrible person is a Buddha. Anyway, before the Buddha was a Buddha, he was a series of animals, and one of the animals that he was a little tiny gray parrot who lived in a forest. And one day he was flying around and he smelled smoke. And he looked down at the forest that was his home and he saw that it was on fire. And his heart was moved to do something about it. And so he summoned up all of his great compassion because he was eventually going to be the Buddha in a future lifetime. So he was a very compassionate little parrot. And he flew to a nearby lake and took water into his beak and then flew back and emptied the water on the forest fire, and it didn't have much of an impact. And then he went back and did it again and did it again and did it again and did it again. And the first time I heard this story, the story ends with, and then he was so exhausted and tired and the fire was still raging that he fell down into the fire and died. One of those happy stories you sometimes encounter in traditional Buddhism. Anyway, so this little parrot has been with me all through these past few weeks, actually for many years. How do we meet the suffering in the world? How do we save all beings? How do we put out the raging forest fire that's consuming everything? And as far as we can tell, has been consuming everything from the very beginning of human existence and will probably continue to consume everything until the great Kalpa fire, as the Buddhists say, or as the scientists say, when the sun goes supernova, when the earth is completely consumed. This will just keep happening. It's always been happening. We have different responses to it. And when we take the precepts, when we study the precepts, what we've inherited as a framework for studying the precepts is that there are three apparently completely different and somewhat contradictory ways of understanding the precepts. So One way is the literal way, and this is the easiest way. We all come into this way through our birthright as Judeo-Christian beings who've grown up in this culture. If you grew up in other cultures, you might have a different sense of this, but most of us have this bias about good and evil being separate, being opposed to each other. Many, many stories about this in our cultural inheritance. And so this literal view, which our ancestors in Zen, in the writings we've inherited on the precepts, called the Hinayana view, which means the small vehicle view, but for political correctness, we no longer call it that. We just call it the literal view, is, save all beings. Get on it. What are you waiting for? If you're a little parrot trying to put out a forest fire, then you just do it. And you get consumed by the flames. This is it. This is the literal view. Do everything you can. Simple, but stark, right? Kind of stark. And then there's another view that we have to take when we encounter the precepts, and that is what we call the view of oneness, of the absolute. In the absolute view, there's no fire. There's no birth and death. There's no little bird. There's no Buddha. There's nothing. This is the view of everything being completely, utterly as it is. No need to make anything different than the way it is. Just life and death do not exist, so what the hell? Live your life. Be present, practice as much as you can, and realize this for yourself. And if the world is burning up around you, no big deal, because the world is burning up around you, and it's always been that way, and it will always be that way. So we come into this absolute view. Now, if that little parrot had taken the absolute view, he wouldn't have kept exhausting himself going to the lake. He would have maybe just found another place to do his zazen where it was a little cooler in temperature. And then we have the we have in our notes as the Mahayana view, which now we call the compassion view, the great vehicle view. In the great vehicle view, there is only doing what we meet as the not the proscriptive, literal meaning of saving all beings, but the recognition that there's no other way to encounter life but to give ourselves fully to whatever suffering we encounter in this moment, and also to give ourselves fully to whatever joy we encounter this moment. In my fantasy, when the little parrot is acting from the compassion view, she flies to the lake and enjoys the spread of her wings, and she dives down and fills her mouth with water, her beak with water, and feels the cool deliciousness of the water, and she flies back and dumps it, and it's just one more thing to do. Oh, gotta go back, back and forth. This is maybe one version of the compassion view. The problem with all of these views is that they're views. They're partial. They can only be utilized from one direction. And when they're utilized from one direction, we can do some pretty terrible things. If we are literalists and we, for example, say in the precept, "I will not tell a lie," we might turn in our neighbor to the Nazis. When we're asked, "Jewish?" Yep. We might do things that, out of honesty, can be very painful. This literal view is sometimes, I view it as the narrow view. Everything is black and white. Everything is good and bad. And there's no room for movement. Just be a good girl. Be a good boy. Do this. Don't do that. Without understanding why we might not do these things, we just try to be good and try to avoid evil. Now, the oneness view has caused lots of suffering in the centuries that Zen has been around, and probably every non-dual teacher in the world gets caught in this. Everything is just the way it is, so it doesn't make any difference what I do. I like to meditate. I love the non-dual. I love the absolute. That's what I'm going for, so who cares about any consequences? The kamikaze pilots during World War II subscribed to this view. Some Zen teachers subscribe to this view. It's kind of a heartless view. It's another kind of starkness. Very different from the narrow view. It's so spacious that no human beings can live in it. At least not for long. We can visit the realm, but we can't live in it. So all by itself, the absolute view is very dangerous. And then the compassion view is interesting because if it's the only view we have, then everything is up for grabs. Should I try to put out this fire? Should I do this? Should I do that? I don't know. What's the most compassionate thing to do? My heart says this, but I don't know. And sometimes when the compassion view is taken to its extreme, everything once again becomes impossible to live inside of. So we say that the mature Zen practitioner embraces all three views at once. How do we do this? Well, we don't. We keep flip-flopping around from one view to another, from one view to another, fully embodying each one as best we can until all on their own, without us doing anything, the three views merge into a kind of wise, compassionate flexibility. Every situation we meet as it is, not through the filter of our mind, which creates dualities, but through our strong and compassionate heart, through our clarity about what causes harm, and through our grounding in this great spacious awareness, in shunyata, in the place where everything is just as it is. They are only contradictory to the ordinary mind, which makes this and that. But when they come together, there's quite a bit of power. And so you can imagine, I was pleased to hear that the story of the little bird has another version. And in that story, the little parrot is going back and forth and back and forth. Who knows what's in the little parrot's mind? Only the necessity of meeting suffering. Perhaps knowing that her life is just one of many lives that can be snuffed out in a moment. Really understanding the true roots of birth and death in emptiness, as well as the yearning of the heart to meet suffering when it arises as fully as possible, and also maybe the sense of having to do something. And the gods in the heavenly realms look down on this little bird going back and forth and back and forth, and they laugh at her, because in their view, they're all stuck in the emptiness realm. Everything is just peachy keen, and there's no problem. Why would you ever do that? And right up here, we have everything we need. We have cool cars and great food and wonderful clothing and all the Netflix streaming we can have. And why would you ever, ever, ever try to put out this fire? It's impossible. And so one of the gods decides to teach the little bird a lesson and transforms itself into a big eagle and comes down and says to the little bird, cut it out. Come up and live with us in the heavenly realms. Just turn away from all this suffering. I'll take you there on my big, powerful wings. Cut it out. And the little bird just ignores it and says, thank you for your advice. And keeps going. And finally falls to earth and dies. But the eagle has been watching this activity and suddenly realizes something. Because even in the heavenly realm, even in the Buddha's palace, we can realize something when we take the bigger view. And the eagle begins to cry. And cries and cries, and all the gods in heaven look down and see the bird crying and say, "What is going on?" And the eagle says, "Look, what happened to this little bird?" And they all start crying, and the fire goes out. There's something in here about not being alone in our bodhisattva activity. There's something in here about bringing it all together. It's a koan. It's not easy to understand. But I have a feeling that David and Josh may be able to help.
So these pure precepts, this little parrot, this great question of how do we live? All of us come here with this question or some question in our hearts. Some longing or some intimation brings us here to sit these long hours, to find out for ourselves, or at least to explore for ourselves. What does it mean to be alive? What does it mean to be alive in this transient world? Some of us now getting up there in the years, but young or old, sick or healthy, if we stop for a moment, we can see the trouble we're in. Right. One teacher said being born human is like setting out to sea in a boat you know will sink. This boat will certainly perish. So how do we live? The sensations and the experiences come and go. Sitting in stillness, we have this wonderful opportunity to see the reality of transience. This great teaching of the Buddha, actually not hidden at all, right? But very clear when we are still enough to see. The arising and passing away, doing well, doing poorly, clear, confused. And so when we begin to see this transience, to see in some ways that nothing is substantial, we can even begin to catch glimpses that this person that we claim to be is merely a smoke and mirrors. This self that we guard so carefully, that we keep such careful track of. Now, where did I come from? How was I doing? And how am I doing now? How will I be? We're constantly checking. Good enough, not good enough. On track, off track. So as we begin to see the insubstantiality of everything, as Melissa said, this perspective of oneness already accomplished. And quite a wonderful thing and important thing to see, to go deeply into the moment, whatever the content is, to be intimate with, to become one with what is right here, this precious wild life, to give away everything, to receive everything, without opinion, without thought. There are moments for all of us, maybe just a glimpse, maybe just a foot on the floor, maybe everything drops away, tears come to your eyes. So precious. And yet these precepts, as we were saying yesterday, are the beginning of entry into the path, and at the end of 10,000 koans, pass through all the gates. What then? Oh, avoid unskillful action. Practice wholesome activity. Save all beings. These invitations to action. We call this bodhisattva activity. We are all little parrots trying to figure out what to do. And when we figure out what to do, it is what is right before us. It is not holy, it is not sacred. It is not spiritual. It is the activity of giving our life to what we love, to doing this deepest work, and then in this doing, in the three drops of water in our beak, and we fly over to the forest fire. I imagine this is the great love song. When we align with the fragility of life, when we see it is not just us, there is no separation, bird, forest, fire, water, laughing gods, crying gods, then we are free. Then in each flap of our wing, in each breath, in and out, everything is accomplished. No need for checking. In this deep alignment, then saving all beings is not an activity of the mind. But heart broken open, heart in the cry of anguish, heart in the great cry of joy. No problem.
So, my fellow parrots. Here we have the vast, all-encompassing crater of the three pure precepts. How do we live this life? This is of utmost importance. And accordingly, I want to talk about invisible punctuation. So, in each of the three pure precepts, as we practice them in this school, there are some invisible hyphens deployed. I hope you, they're sometimes not apparent in this particular font, but I want to point them out to you. Not knowing, thereby giving up fixed ideas about myself and the universe. Myself and the universe. One thing. Myself and the universe. Bearing witness to the joy and suffering of the world. The joy and suffering. This one thing rising and falling in different ways, sometimes cresting with this wave, sometimes with that wave, sometimes in stillness, but always just this ocean of joy and suffering, this ocean of myself in the universe. And honoring wholeness in myself and others. This one thing that is myself and others. So much pressure on us if we have to be good, if we have to be enough, if we have to personally do it all or at all. But when we meet the universe, myself in the universe, myself and others, there's much more space. And this is oneness, it is non-separation, but it is a oneness and a non-separation that is continually manifesting in diversity. And in manifesting in diversity, it is coming forth in harmony. And what if the practice that takes place isn't yours, but is the property of myself in the universe? What if the liberation that we reach isn't something that you get to have, but is something manifested by yourself in the universe? What if sitting this period, this breath, this retreat, this lifetime of Sesshin, what if this is being done by yourself and others? And what if we don't have to separate out? And it's not that we have to bear witness to the suffering. We have to bear witness to the suffering. Really bear witness to the suffering. And then maybe we can bear some witness to some joy, too. Maybe I'll get some joy to bear witness to. But man, bearing witness to the suffering. What if we don't have to do it like that? What if everywhere we look, what we see is joy and suffering? Right here, this body, this breath, joy and suffering. This gratitude, these knees, joy and suffering. And there is one last point I want to make, moving on from invisible hyphens. And that has to do with the first pure precept. Cease from evil. Desist. There is a quality of this practice that begins first from restraint. It doesn't end with restraint, but it actually really, really does begin first with desisting, ceasing, coming into the stillness of Zazen, ceasing from putting fuel onto the fire of karmic habit, ceasing from just habitually responding from grasping and fear and stories. Ceasing. And from this quality of stillness, from this quality of restraint, is born the possibility of skillful, delicate, care-filled action. So please sit comfortably, and we invite you to come forth in resonance and comment in the Dharma dialogue. I want to invite people to raise your hands high, because it actually is quite hard to see many people. And if you are on the far side of the fireplace and you wish to raise your hand, you may need to come around and wave it or lift it. And I particularly want to invite to speak all of any of the folks who might be a little slower to respond than the most verbal of some of us.
I'm heartened by the possibilities in your talks, and each one today, and it just opens up many opportunities, many possibilities. Melissa, I have been searching for a way, personally, to integrate my experience with Theravadan Buddhism with Zen. I am a newcomer to Zen. Most of my learning has been in Theravadan Buddhism. And I think increasingly we see in the literature, at least, some coming together, some common ground of the various traditions on both sides, at least in the West. You know, we're seeing some of that. It raises the question of how to maintain an identity, how to be a Zen practitioner in the wider world of Buddhism, and I just use that as a model of how to be oneself in the wider world of all self. So I think that provides, you know, a vehicle, you know, for personalizing ways in which we can practice, be the kind of people who we want to be, but understanding that the individual it's not only limited, doesn't even exist in some ways, because we are one and all. Thank you.
Thank you, Donna. Yeah, you're touching on a number of really important themes. How do we come forth? How do we come forth in our specificity, even amid this ocean and of oneness? And what is the value we find from our practice of Buddhism? Melissa was using the term traditional Buddhism. I want to just clarify that we have a tradition of Buddhism in Zen. It is a 12, 13, 14, 1500 year tradition. All of these things pointing to in similar directions, with different language, some that resonates in our heart one way, some that resonates another, some that we don't connect to, some that was useful before but is now shifting. These aren't things to be answered or solved, but continuously met.
Camden. Yeah, so I like the whole image of the little bird getting the chance to take care of fire. That kind of place in my life right now where I'm trying to find a fire that I can take care of. It seems like there's so many fires out there in every direction. And it's just so much of like an option or a choice. What fire needs the most help? It's just, it's been a pretty pulling aspect.
And I want to say there are different stages of our life and different times, and sometimes it seems like there's so many options and how to choose, and sometimes so few options. This place of self and other, as Josh was saying, I think for all of us, how to find the work that that we love, it's not just where's the greatest need, but what is the activity that brings me joy? And I think that deep joy, because the self is not separate, the fire and the parrot appearing as two, but I think how wonderful for you to be consciously at this place and trying to sense. This is not a decision of the mind, but somehow to trust if you follow what is deepest in your heart, one that you cannot know how to do it. Some of us old folks can look back and say, well, yeah, I decided this, and then I decided that, and well, clearly. But we're just making that up. We don't know how we got here. And we're still at this place. How do I? So thank you for bringing that up. And just to encourage, this is a time of faith and of this deep listening and trusting that there is some path, some bodhisattva path, where self and other are not separate, where I am not the good person helping those other people, but we meet, me and my work, me and the world, self and other, self and the universe, expressed here. So thank you.
I think also pulling on one string and the whole sweater unravels. So don't imagine that doing work in one place is to the exclusion of every other fire that's happening.
Yeah.
Pick a fire and all the fires diminish.
Yes.
Lois.
So the not knowing is very clear, but how not to just be a parent who doubts all the time, who you know, well, I shouldn't carry the water, it's not going to do any good. I should not carry the water, it's not going to do any good. How do you move to skillful action through that?
That's a beautiful depiction of the problem with the compassion view only, that we keep getting caught in this wibbly-wobble thing. And I think what David was just saying and what James just said really are very apropos here, that I was thinking when Camden spoke how lucky we are to have choices about which fire to put our attention to. You know, there's certain times in our lives and many, many people in the world who don't have that option of saying, I wonder which one. You know, the bomb's falling here, right? The flood waters are rising here, so this is where we go. Then there's no choice. So to appreciate the difficulty of choosing is important here. To not know what to do, and then to do what calls to your heart, and to trust that any thread will unravel the whole sweater. You know, that this, if everything really is interconnected, and we get a sense that might be true, that means that what James said is deeply true. So in I always remember a story we heard about Sung San, the founder of the Kwannon School in Rhode Island, who's an ancestor of David's, a Dharma ancestor, who, when people would come to him to say, what should I do? Should I do this or should I do that? He didn't speak English that well, and he would say, got coin? Right? And that's an amazing teaching. It doesn't matter. And everything matters. So, whole heart, one thread, go for it.
And I want to reflect the backside of that too. So you have identified that the parrot doing her little parrot beak water delivery doesn't fix it. The parrot not doing her little parrot beak water delivery doesn't fix it. And so fixing it in a really important way is off the table. And there is not nihilism in that. There is great freedom. There is a possibility for just responding and meeting, free from fixation on measurement and outcome and result. Because it turns out that all that comes into being will go out of being. And the essence of this is at the most basic level the nature of suffering. Suffering, it means that things that are born will die. Sickness, old age, death, loss, change. Actually curing these things is off the table. And that means how we meet this moment and this situation is so completely important precisely because of that.
And you know, that's what we're doing here. At Sesshin, we get to big time meet what's, you know, things seem really important on Sesshin. Like, you know, somebody took too long in the shower. That's as bad as a war in Sierra Leone. It's just like, or somebody just, you know, sniffs at an inopportune time and you just want to, right? This is where we get to practice. It's amazing how human beings just do this naturally. And I loved what Josh just said, because I think it's an important reminder, and yet another view of this teaching is, we are not the center of the universe, and we cannot control everything. In fact, we can barely control anything.
And even that might be an overstatement.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So, and I think this, you know, the story of the gods in the heaven part of the story is really important. Mm-hmm. This is a self and other together action. Life.
And to say that the point of Sesshin is not Sesshin.
Right. Right.
Right. The point is our life, and I think that's what you're pointing to. And the five remembrances, you know, is acknowledging no cure for old age, no cure for sickness, no cure for death, no cure for this world where everything is coming and going. But our deeds are our only companions, right? The possibility at any moment to act. And I think oftentimes Zen appears to be quite about not doing, and absolutely what Josh said, first you must desist. You must. escape from the trance of everyday life, right? And it's a fierce thing. And then what? It's not about staying in that oneness or whatever we discover, but it's about doing something. So two great injunctions of Zen. Do nothing. Do nothing. And do something. Anything. Do something. You will learn. Whatever you do, the world will meet you and teach you exactly what you need to know. Yeah. Thank you so much. Carol has her hand up.
Carolyn.
Carolyn.
Yeah. I thought you picked me after somebody else. Melissa actually just touched on what I was going to say, but I'll say it again. The one thing about this koan that sort of brings up for me an issue I often have in Zen generally is around this issue of the individual action and acting as part of a group, which you also talked about earlier in the, you know, the supplication, the sense that you can't do this by yourself. So it was interesting. I kept waiting for the fourth option, where he goes and calls the god birds, right? Or the, you know, the fire, the bird fire. I mean, really, we talk about we can't ultimately have control, and that is true. But there are times where trying not to do it by yourself and recognizing that you can't is the skillful action.
Myself
and
others.
Going back and forth. You know, even if you totally accept, which I always struggle with some, the idea of being the same as the others and the same as the fire. In our real life, you still have real fires to put out, and you often do them much better with help.
Yeah. Yeah. And in an important way, you're pointing to the value of seeing that this is only done by myself and others, which we can also spin as others and myself.
But not just as a concept of myself and others, right? Sometimes actually going and knocking on their door and saying, there's a fire, could you come help me?
Well, yeah, nothing here is about the concept. Yeah. That's a very dangerous thing, right? When we get caught in the mind, we're lost. Although, you know, thank goodness for our minds. Everything has two sides.
Diane.
No, I was trying to make sure you saw Ray.
Ray.
Ray's hiding in plain sight.
I was struck by what you said, Josh, about not fixing. And, I mean, I've seen for myself that fixing is feeling that I can't bear the suffering, can't witness it and be with it fully, that at least I can get some comfort if I try to fix it. And it's unfixable, ultimately. I mean, I do a little bit and I say, oh, I've made somebody's life a little easier. At least, you know, they're not suffering as much as they were. Well, they've got some way out, maybe, of their suffering. And but ultimately, so that's, you know, my trying to fix what is seems so overwhelming to just be with. You know, and yet there's the other piece too, as you're talking about the joy, that when I can let go of that, that there is a way in which the universe, you know, provides. It's like I don't have to go looking for joy. It's there already in some way that mm-hmm. when I fixate, I don't see it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And on that last point, it's actually woven into the fabric of the universe, is the way I sometimes see it. And this is why, you know, when we sit, the thing that happens when we desist, when we start by ceasing, is that And is that gratitude actually naturally arises. We don't have to manufacture it or find it. And no matter how many hell realms we spend a period or five in of this sesshin, at the end of every sesshin, what we express is gratitude.
Mostly.
You don't have to manufacture it, don't worry.
And I also want to pick up on the first part of what you said, that often this impulse to fix is because I want to feel better. I want to feel better about me. I want to feel better about my efficacy. I want to feel some way and not some other way. And so we try to fix. And because there are small things in the universe that we actually can fix, we mistakenly extrapolate infinitely outward and think that because we can fix tiny things sometimes, we can fix everything always if we are just effective enough. And actually, the illusion is that we can even fix tiny things sometimes. Even that is an illusion.
And yet, you're speaking for the opposition. And yet, you know, Ray, you know, to meet one person where they are, and to give them some moment of ease, to witness, to be willing to feel so uncomfortable. In that little act, everything is accomplished. Everything is fixed. Not in the way we would, our head would imagine it, but in the fullness of that activity, a kind gesture is the fulfillment of our bodhisattva vow.
And, what he said.
And yet another version of this same teaching. I was also moved by you being moved, Ray, when you talked about it. You know the pain of wanting to fix so deeply. And there's, I think many of us have probably heard about the difference between fixing and healing, or curing and healing. There is a healing gesture that we make when we recognize this interconnection between us, this other and self, the same. That is mysteriously a balm for us. You know, it's not just one person doing one thing to connect in the heart is so profound, and it sends ripples throughout the whole universe. You know, and we know that we've encountered it. Every one of us in this room has encountered the touch of a hand, somebody actually meeting our gaze, a word given in kindness. These things are powerful beyond measure. And so sometimes it is up to us to be that little bird. It really is, in whatever way we can, knowing, not being caught in the delusion that it's up to us to fix, repair. It's up to us to meet those broken places fully, without trying to change them. And they change, because everything's always changing. All these Buddhist teachings are so cool. Okay, Bob, just rest his head.
I just have one. I've been sort of watching us go down these three different paths, like in our different comments, and I realized that when I'm by myself, I feel like I'm a rat in a maze, and I go down the path of compassion, and then I get stuck. And then I go down the literal path, and I get really stuck. And then I go down the emptiness path, and I give up. And, you know, it may be really hard. I think this gets back to Carolyn's sort of point, that having all these voices may be so essential, because all by ourselves, we can just go down one path too easily and stay there and not know how to get out. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that I'm just listening to how healing this dialogue is for me, who's been kind of stuck for a little while in some bad places. And the listening to all this really is just opening and easing things. Mm-hmm.
There's actually a room full of rats all going down these paths, right? So all of the paths are getting covered by myself, the rat, and others, the rat.
And I had this wonderful view when you were talking about the maze of, you know, just a couple of inches above it.
Yeah.
No problem. it's just, you can almost see us putting up our walls. We're like, me, 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 me. Cheese, cheese, cheese. Yeah. Well, so thank you all. What a wonderful Dharma dialogue.